Thank you for joining Esquire CLE today. My name is Max Elliott. I am the founder and managing attorney of the law offices of Max Elliott. We focus on estate planning, estate preservation, and business planning. Our offices are located in Chicago and New York, New York. Thank you for joining us today and listening to the presentation. And I hope these materials will be of assistance to you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you to Esquire CLE for inviting me to provide this presentation. It's quite an honor, and I'm very excited to do so. And one more special shout out to my team members, James Davis and Julian Love, for helping me with the research. So today we're going to talk about marriage equality in the crosshairs, estate planning protections amidst targeted discrimination. We're going to discuss a lot of constitutional law, kind of harkening back to those school days, because the Constitution, especially the penumbras of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, are inherently critical to the jurisprudence surrounding, and that provides the foundation for marriage equality. Now, the Marriage Equality March began long ago, but in recent years gained steam and culminated in a victory with the Supreme Court ruling in Obergefell v. Hodges. However, many jurisdictions and organizations continue to disregard Obergefell and proactively work to undermine the principles of the jurisprudence on which Obergefell rests. And also, many loving and committed couples in the LGBTQ community have affirmatively decided not to marry for valid reasons. So under these circumstances, LGBTQ couples and persons face even greater challenges when trying to provide for their loved ones. Now, as I stated, marriage equality jurisprudence is derived from the bedrock of individual rights jurisprudence that's not expressly provided for in the United States Constitution. So Marriage Equality Foundation is constitutional and also based on case law. The bedrock, like I stated, known as the penumbras, was articulated through holdings in landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases that speak to the rights and freedoms of individuals, those rights and freedoms implied in the Bill of Rights, particularly the First, Fifth, and Ninth Amendments, and also the 14th Amendment. So when we look at the marriage equality constitutional foundation, particularly the penumbras, the First Amendment, which provides, as we know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to peaceably assemble, in terms of being proactively protective of our clients, we really focus on freedom of association. People should be able to be with and associate with who they want. The Fifth Amendment, of course, that we all know is the amendment that provides due process of law and equal protection of laws with respect to the federal government. So it's very important that the federal government also proactively protect LGBTQ couples and persons. The Ninth Amendment is kind of what I consider, like we know in estate planning, we have pour-over wills. So the Ninth Amendment is like a pour-over constitutional provision. Anything that the Constitution, rights that the Constitution provides are included, but just because rights are not included in the Constitution does not mean that the states should not recognize those rights, of the rights of their citizens. And that, of course, goes to the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment is really essential because we're in a pluralistic society where there are we have states who have kind of multiple personalities, if you will. So it's really important that all of the states actually provide due process of law and equal protection of the laws for their citizens. So the 14th Amendment is used almost in every particular piece of case law that involves the marriage equality jurisprudence. Now, speaking of that case law, there are several very important cases: Griswold v. Connecticut, Loving v. Commonwealth of Virginia, Baker v. Nelson, Lawrence Romer v. Evans, Lawrence v. Texas, Bowers v. Hardwick, and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So I'm going to discuss each one of those, some a little bit more than others, but these are the essential cases involved with marriage equality jurisprudence. So again, equally essential to the 14th Amendment is the first case, Griswold v. Connecticut. Now, one kind of may ask, well, how does Griswold actually apply with respect to marriage equality? Well, the issue in Griswold began as one of access to contraception, but ended up being whether a state law violated a married couple's right to privacy. So Griswold is very important because it is the first case that articulated the privacy zones, which are now elemental with respect to our privacy rights. Although Justice Douglas actually wrote the opinion, it was Justice Goldberg's concurring opinion that provided the more compelling arguments and analysis. So in Griswold, the state argued that the case analysis should be based on the due process clause of the 14th Amendment as it relates to economic, business, or social situations. There was a couple who sought contraceptives from a Planned Parenthood clinic in Connecticut, and they were actually charged, and they appealed on the basis of due process violations. And the state argued that this case was actually about business. It wasn't about privacy. The court disagreed, and Justice Goldberg, as I mentioned, discussed that previous case law found privacy zones, such as one's house, one's persons, papers, or effects, and that certain rights are fundamental. And the right to be left alone in the home is fundamental to marital privacy. The next case that's very important with respect to marriage equality is Loving v. Virginia, because it actually provides the foundation for marriage equality among different groups. Many of you are probably familiar with the case where the Supreme Court struck down anti-miscegenation statutes. In 1958, Mildred and Richard Loving lived in Virginia, and they left Virginia to get married in Washington, D.C. They returned to Virginia and were charged and found guilty of violating Virginia's anti-miscegenation statute. Well, like I said, the Supreme Court found that Virginia had no rational reason for a law prohibiting interracial marriage, that marriage is a fundamental right, and the court stated it can't conceive of a valid legislative purpose that makes the color of a person's skin the test of whether their conduct is criminal. And moving along, the very first now really critical on-point case with respect to marriage equality is Baker v. Nelson, because Baker v. Nelson was the first case in which the rights of LGBTQ couples to marry was brought into the court system. So in Baker v. Nelson, the court considered whether the relevant Minnesota statute authorized same-sex marriage, and if not, whether the state was required to authorize same-sex marriage. Now, Baker v. Nelson is actually a Minnesota case, and I'll talk about why that is in a second, but the couple, Richard Baker and James McConnell, applied for a marriage license in Minnesota, and the county clerk, Gerald Nelson, refused their application. And they appealed, and the Minnesota Supreme Court considered two arguments brought by them. The first was that the Minnesota statute did not expressly prohibit same-sex marriage, so therefore legislative intent was for the state to authorize same-sex marriage. The court disagreed, citing the definition of marriage provided by Webster's and Black Law's dictionaries, and both definitions provided that marriage was a union between members of the opposite sex. So Baker and McConnell next argued that Minnesota's prohibition on same-sex marriage actually violated their constitutional rights per the Ninth and Fourteenth Amendments, denying their rights to liberty and property without due process, and also not providing them with equal protection under the laws. Once again, the court rejected this argument, explaining that their second contention presumed that same-sex marriage was a fundamental right. And the couple then argued a counterpoint using Griswold, but the court actually interpreted Griswold as supporting its holding, indicating that Justice Douglas, like I stated earlier, who wrote the opinion, stated that Connecticut statute actually applied to husband and wife, not husband and husband. So finally, Baker and McConnell tried to use Loving v. Virginia, and the court again rejected the analogy completely, stating that Loving was about race and the case at bar was about gender. They took the case up to the Supreme Court, but did not file a petition requesting cert. So the Supreme Court just dismissed the case, and Baker v. Nelson's holding in Minnesota actually became precedent for decades. The next case with respect to marriage equality is Bowers v. Hardwick. Now, this is important because previously I just talked about cases involving married persons or people who wanted to be married. Hardwick stands for the violation of privacy rights for unmarried people. So Michael Hardwick was arrested in 1982 in Georgia and charged with violating Georgia's sodomy law. The district attorney refused to prosecute the case for lack of evidence. But Hardwick sued anyway, claiming that Georgia, in prohibiting sodomy or other sexual activity, violated his constitutional rights. The district court dismissed the suit for a failure to state a claim, and he continued to appeal. And the 11th Circuit actually reversed the district court's decision, citing Griswold and the right of privacy. But the state actually appealed. Other courts disagreed, and so the Supreme Court of the United States agreed to hear the case to resolve the split among the jurisdictions. The court framed the issue as being whether the U.S. Constitution provided a fundamental right to the LGBTQ community to participate in same-sex intimacy. Hardwick argued, using other Supreme Court cases such as Griswold v. Connecticut and Eisenstadt v. Baird, but the court asserted that there was no link between those cases and his because those cases involved family, marriage, or procreation. As I mentioned before, the previous case law was about married people. This was about someone who was unmarried. And so the court goes on to try to say, we're not really going to judge the morality of individuals, but the law is, however, constantly based on notions of morality. And this is an issue or an element that is starting to actually come to the surface again in today's climate. So with Hardwick, Bowers v. Hardwick, the court really focused on the act itself, sexual acts itself, not privacy. And it was not considering morals, it said, but stated that morals are the foundation of laws. So the next case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, we are all pretty much familiar with. It was a challenge to reproductive rights statute. This one was actually, this case actually found in favor of the plaintiffs with respect to the burden that women would have in the event they needed to seek an abortion. The court here stated that instead of using a temporal test in order to determine whether the individual would be able to obtain an abortion, the test should be one of actual burden. Concurring justices explained regulations which do no more than create a structural mechanism by which the state or the parent or guardian of a minor may express profound respect for life, for the life of the unborn, are permitted if they are not a substantial obstacle to the women's exercise, to the woman's exercise of the right to choose. So again, it's not about the timing, it's really about the burden that's placed on the individual. The next case with respect to marriage equality is Romer v. Evans. And this case was essential because it stands for the duty to protect LGBTQ citizens against stigma. So in the early 1990s, several Colorado municipalities passed ordinances prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. However, the Colorado legislature proposed and actually passed Amendment 2, which was a referendum that would change Colorado's constitution and actually repeal those ordinances. LGBTQ Colorado citizens sued to enjoin the amendment's implementation, contending that it was unconstitutional. The trial court and the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado actually agreed with them, but the state appealed, arguing that Amendment 2 treats LGBTQ persons just like everybody else. It just denies them special rights. Nobody deserves special rights. But the Supreme Court actually explained that, you know, Amendment 2 did not deny special rights, but actually withdrew rights from LGBTQ persons that all other Colorado citizens actually had. The court explained the ordinances in question weren't providing special rights, but were actually codifying the duty of the state not to discriminate. At the beginning of Romer, Justice Kennedy read from Justice Harlan's dissent in the infamous Plessy v. Ferguson, stating that the Constitution neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. And he later anchored Romer, stating emphatically that the only reason for the referendum and any law like it would be one to promote animus against a particular class of citizens. And Romer is actually also starting to reemerge as an issue in marriage equality and LGBTQ rights and discrimination in today's climate. Another case that's also very critical is Lawrence v. Texas. And again, many of us all know about this particular case. It's a landmark case as well. It's critical because it overruled Bowers v. Hardwick. In 2000, 2002, Houston, Texas police went to a residence after receiving information about a ruckus involving weapons. John Lawrence and Teron Garner were engaged in sexual activity when the police entered the home. And so both of them were charged and convicted of deviant sexual intercourse, which was a violation of the Texas statute. In their defense, John and Teron challenged the statute as unconstitutional. Again, here we have a court whose deliberations are now focused on cases involving unmarried people, because the court first turned to Griswold, and that was for marital relationships. But after
Esquire CLE's first verification code is GOLF, G-O-L-F, GOLF. Please take a moment to write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is GOLF, G-O-L-F, GOLF. Please take a moment to write this down.
After Griswold, it went to Eisenstadt v. Baird, which decided issues of personal rights of unmarried persons involving contraceptives. It then went to Roe v. Wade, and then it went to Carey v. Population Services, again, about the sale of contraceptives to unmarried persons under 16. The court also discussed how the issue was framed in Bowers, stating that the framing in Bowers was too narrow because, like I said, it focused on the act as opposed to privacy. And here the court said it did not focus on liberty. So we can see here where the court in Lawrence v. Texas is starting to move toward unraveling Bowers. The court acknowledged the importance of the Bowers rationale to a certain extent, recognizing that the court in Bowers was rightfully giving a voice to those who held strong moral convictions. The court went on, though, to qualify that recognition by stating that the court's job is to define liberty, not to push through society's moral ideologies. So the Bowers decision to address morals was correct, but they should not have pushed the morals through. The court also finally, statement of the court with respect to the holding in Lawrence v. Texas was the fact that the doctrine of stare decisis is important. It provides the law and society with stability. And again, it's odd that this doctrine is now emerging again in question to a lot of cases that are coming up. But stare decisis is not absolute. And we can see now how the stare decisis language in Lawrence v. Texas is actually a double-edged sword, because we can use it to say the language is not absolute and people need protections. And so where there was a case that took away those protections or didn't provide those protections, we're not going to follow that precedent. But now that can actually, depending on the disposition of the court, it can now use that argument to when it has interpreted that those protections are no longer needed. So we just talked about the marriage equality jurisprudence penumbras cases, and going forward, we find that Lawrence v. Texas was the pivotal case in actually providing recognition of privacy to LGBTQ citizens at the very least. However, there were cracks with respect to marriage equality jurisprudence, the first one being DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. We all know about DOMA defining marriage as the union between one man and one woman. That was enacted, signed into law in 1996, but was actually overruled. The next case in terms of marriage equality penumbras provided a little glue to the crack that Doma had enacted, and also a lot of states also started using this glue. But the first state to do so was the state of Vermont in Baker v. State of Vermont, and it involved legally recognizing civil unions, whereas LGBTQ couples could not necessarily marry. Vermont recognized the benefits, the obligations, burdens, responsibilities, and most importantly, the status that marriage affords couples, and decided to provide a structure in which LGBTQ couples could actually obtain those benefits. So let's talk about a hypothetical. The rambunctious professor. So it's 1989 in Colorado. Your client and their partner were in your client's home one evening. The home is located on a private university's campus. Your client is a university professor. On this particular evening, students phoned the campus police, stating they feared domestic violence was occurring. The campus police go to the residence and allegedly hear screaming and furniture being knocked over. The police break down the door and file a report with the university regarding what they witnessed. And subsequently, the provost asks your client to move. What recourse does your client have? Well, again, it's 1989 in Colorado. There really are no rights with respect to privacy. With respect to privacy for LGBTQ persons, Lawrence v. Texas has actually yet to be decided. Romer v. Evans has not been decided. This is on a private university's campus, so therefore, unless the university is actually receiving federal funding, there really isn't even a constitutional claim of privacy that Griswold would have provided. So unfortunately, your client does not have a lot of recourse. So, as we can see, the cases move along and start to provide the important privacy rights for LGBTQ couples. And as we started talking about, Baker v. State of Vermont led to civil unions. The very first case that actually provided the right of marriage is Goodrich v. Department of Public Health. It's the case, like I said, that is essential because not only did it provide marriage equality, but it lays the foundation for states' rights to actually protect their LGBTQ citizens. Seven same-sex couples filed suit against the Massachusetts Department of Health after they were denied issuances of their marriage licenses. The Department of Health argued 3 points. The purpose of marriage was procreation. Heterosexual marriage provides the healthiest environments conducive to raising children, and preventing same-sex marriage helps to preserve the resources of the state. Couples intended that that Massachusetts was violating their equal protection rights. So the trial court ruled in favor of the Department of Health, but the Massachusetts Supreme Court reversed the lower court's ruling, stating that the Department of Health did not have a rational basis for preventing same-sex couples from getting married. The biological argument regarding procreation was actually pretextual. The next case that really lifted Goodrich up was, of course, U.S. v. Windsor. We're all also pretty much familiar with that. It's another very important marriage equality case because here, not just the state court, but the United States Supreme Court actually recognized marriage equality. Edie and Thea were married in Toronto, Canada, and their marriage was recognized by New York. Thea consequently died. Edie was her executor, and Thea had left everything to Edie. And as we know in estate planning world, when somebody dies and leaves a substantial estate, we have to file tax returns. And if they're married, surviving spouse generally receives their inheritance tax-free. However, because of DOMA, the IRS actually imposed a levy of $363,000 in taxes on Edie. The IRS, like I said, used DOMA, but then Attorney General Eric J. Holder announced that the Department of Justice would not defend DOMA in this action because Edie, of course, filed suit. And the Supreme Court actually affirmed the New York ruling, albeit narrowly, and stated that the estate tax issue lawfully applies to married same-sex, applies to lawfully married same-sex couples. So we saw how civil unions started to redefine the battleground in states of Illinois, in Vermont, and then also legislative support started pouring in as states around the country started to enact their marriage laws, such as Illinois. And finally, we get to Obergefell v. Hodges, which was decided a few years ago in 2015. Now, the case was born of Obergefell v. Kasich, where two men, one who was terminally ill, were married in Maryland and sought to have their marriage recognized in Ohio via a death certificate for a surviving spouse. And several other same-sex couples from Kentucky, Michigan, and Tennessee faced the same problem. In 2014, they filed for petition for cert, and in 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court consolidated the cases under Hodges and granted cert. And in a plurality opinion authored by Justice Kennedy on June 26, 2015, the court ruled in favor of marriage equality for the country. The decision was undergirded by the Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So as I stated in the very beginning, the 14th Amendment is really critical to marriage equality and actually all case law involving protecting individuals and groups from discrimination. And part of the opinion in relevant reads, as some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. So as we can see, especially in estate planning circles, the issue of marriage and that it actually precedes or it actually continues past death, and those rights should still be respected, is very important. And Obergefell holds for that, stands for that. Now, equally important, however, is Chief Justice Roberts' dissent. The part of his dissent that stands out is where he analogized the coming cloud over marriage equality to that of the cloud over racial equality. Perhaps he was being prescient, but in today's climate, that is a very sobering statement. And going forward, as we can see, post-Obergefell, there are marriage equality highs and lows. One of the lows, if we will, is Masterpiece Cake Shop, v. Craig and Mullins, that started in Colorado and made its way up to the Supreme Court and was actually just decided this year. The issue in Masterpiece cake shop was whether a Colorado business could be accepted from a Colorado law that prohibits sexual orientation discrimination on the grounds of religious beliefs. The couple's brief explained how debate had continued regarding religious beliefs and discriminatory action, but the law was clear. This action is illegal in the marketplace. Here, a baker refused to make cakes for LGBTQ couples and really didn't start to articulate any reason until the case began to go up to the appellate, go up to the Supreme Court, where the reason then was articulated as religious freedom. Now, like I said, the case was decided this year, but on technical grounds. However, the arguments posed for Phillips, the baker, illustrate a trending issue with respect to how certain segments of our population and our legal professionals and politicians are actually targeting LGBTQ rights, and considering this target in light of other cases decided by the Roberts Court could actually prove beneficial to LGBTQ rights advocates. However, there was a case in 2015 that was actually positive, and it was decided right after Obergefell came down. It involved children born into marriages of same-sex couples in Arkansas. The couples wanted both of their names on the birth certificates. Arkansas refused, and they appealed. And the Supreme Court explained that Obergefell clearly ruled against disparate treatment of same-sex married couples. But again, that was in 2015. We're in a different climate now. And that climate may have bearing on Maruf v. Azar, which is a case based on religious freedom, where couples challenged the government, stating that it violated their constitutional rights by using their taxpayer dollars to fund services that discriminated against them. Two lesbian married couples really wanted to adopt or be foster parents, and could not even complete the application process because the organization through which they sought adoption decided that their family was unsuitable because it did not mirror the Holy Family. And so Fatma Maruf and Bryn Esplin brought suit, charging that this organization and the federal government actually violated its DHS, violated the Establishment Clause, the Equal Protection Clause of the Fifth Amendment, and the Substantive Due Process Clause under the Fifth Amendment. The case is still pending, but the climate that they're in is not as friendly as the climate that was decided in Pavan v. Smith. Other cases that we should at least be mindful of are cases involving standing. The case of the two pigeons that I like to call involved lawfully married spouses who were actually just trying to really be proactive and make sure that benefits were not going to be taken away. And of course, because they did not have an issue at the end of the case, they lost on standing. Another case, Barber v. Bryant, which came out of Mississippi, based on Mississippi's mini DOMA, employees who worked and resided in Mississippi and a gay man who intended to marry brought an action against Mississippi's governor and the Department of Human Services because they were fearful that their rights would be taken away and that this mini DOMA would, even in the light of Obergefell and Windsor, would still be given effectuation, would be effectuated. And the appellate court in that case actually didn't even reference the defendant's arguments advocating for the statute, but used the entire opinion to explain the premise and jurisprudence behind standing. Standing requires that a plaintiff, of course, suffer a cognizable injury. They had not suffered a cognizable injury, but they also contended that the potential for discrimination as a basis for unconstitutionality is found in Romer v. Evans. And this is really important because the court ignored the Romer's stigma language altogether, but it's somewhat understandable. You have to have standing in order to have a court hear the merits of your argument. So the court found that they did not have standing, and the Fifth Circuit, though, reversed the injunction and remanded the case for dismissal, but they also filed an appeal. Another very important case is Birchfield v. Armstrong. Again, here we have a case involving widowers. The plaintiff's deceased spouses died in Florida in 2013 and in 2014. And at the time, Florida had a mini DOMA, had a number of laws discriminating against LGBTQ persons. And they wanted the widows wanted their names on the death certificates of their departed loved ones, and Florida refused. So they brought a lawsuit, and the Florida court actually found in favor. The trial court did not. The Florida appellate court actually found in favor and stated that it is as a matter of federal constitutional law, per Obergefell, a state cannot properly refuse to correct a federal constitutional violation going forward, even if the violation arose before the dispute over the constitutional issue was settled. So it's very important here that we are mindful of what this case is saying, because it's providing states with the right to protect their citizens. Consider a hypothetical. Chris and Dana are civil union partners residing in Idaho. Chris is pregnant, and they want to convert their civil union into a marriage. They apply for a marriage license with Idaho's Department of Family Services. The department also receives federal funding. The clerk denies their application, citing religious grounds. Dana and Chris file suit. But unfortunately, 10 days before the preliminary hearing, Dana dies in a car crash. But still, Chris is adamant about being listed on Dana's death certificate as a surviving spouse. So there are a number of issues here. We don't know exactly when this happened. So let's say this happened before Obergefell. But they're civil union partners, and Obergefell really wouldn't matter anyway. Does Idaho recognize civil union partners? If they do, then, and if they're like other states that have civil union partners, then Chris should actually be listed on the death certificate, but not as a surviving spouse, as a surviving partner of a civil union. Is there recourse with respect to with respect to the Constitution? Well, Family Services receives federal funding, so perhaps there is some recourse under the Fifth Amendment. But as we'll see in a couple of minutes, that might also be problematic in today's climate. The next case with respect to the rights of widows and widowers, Zawadzki and Gaspari v. Brewer Funeral Services, is very important because here we have a case that is now bringing about moral convictions again, as discussed in Romer, as discussed in Bowers v. Hardwick. The surviving spouse, Jack, and his deceased spouse's nephew, John, filed a complaint against a funeral home and its owners for breach of contract. Jack and his deceased spouse were a loving couple living together for more than 52 years. and Bob was eventually placed in a nursing home. But before that, they had moved from Colorado to Mississippi, got married after Obergefell, and were having a lovely life in Picayune. Again, Bob was then unfortunately placed in a nursing home because he had a really grave heart problem. John and knew that he was dying, so the nephew took the responsibility of searching for a funeral home that could provide services in Picayune so Bob's body would not have to be transferred far. The couple's friends and family could focus on helping each other through the grieving period. But when the funeral home learned that Jack and Bob were actually a gay married couple, they refused to provide services, and John had to run around at the last minute to find services.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is King. K-I-N-G, King. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is King. K-I-N-G, King. Please take a moment and write this down.
Service that would provide them with their memorial needs, and it was 90 miles away, and friends and family could not attend. So they sued. Unfortunately, Jack now died in December of 2017, so a petition has been filed to substitute his nephew as plaintiff. Now, I have been discussing the climate today, and so let's look at really quickly recent federal treatment of LGBTQ families and persons with respect to congressional legislation. The titles may sound innocuous and even beneficial, but when you dig into them, we can understand how they really adversely affect LGBTQ families and persons. The Civil Rights Uniformity Act would allow for discrimination perpetrated upon transgender persons without any, and transgender persons would have no legal recourse. The Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Act sounds friendly, but it actually eliminates the best interest standard for determining how and who should receive benefits. The First Amendment Defense Act, or FADA, is very, very important because it provides nearly unfettered exemptions in the name of religious freedom for persons and organizations of or related to the federal government who would otherwise be required to provide goods or services to members of the LGBTQ community. So we see here legislation that is using morals that was discussed in Griswold, and that was also used in Bowers v. Hardwick to deprive protections that Lawrence actually overturned. So now we see that the deprivation of protections coming back, and as courts gave deference to marriage, legislatures began to revisit, like I said, this issue of morals and religions. Considering what happened in October 2017, where the United States Department of Justice mandated agencies to be very lenient with workers requesting exemptions for religious purposes. HHS authorized any employer insurance to withhold contraceptives. And sometimes people may think that that is minuscule, but again, contraceptives are very important with respect to A, health and health care. And states' legislative treatments are also now starting to become more adverse. There are 21 states that have Religious Freedom Restoration Act statutes exempting persons and organizations from adhering to anti-discrimination statutes. So as we can see, marriage equality is still being opposed in a number of jurisdictions. And so if we consider that married LGBTQ couples are having problems, those who are cohabitating are having even more difficulty. For example, in the materials, we talk about cases where individuals don't even have standing in courts, because they are not spouses. U.S. v. Windsor actually, although it provided recognition of lawfully married LGBTQ couples, it states the incidence, benefits, and obligations of marriage are uniform for all married couples within each state, though they may vary, subject to constitutional guarantees from one state to the next. So, again, we see it's very marriage, pro-marriage, I'm sorry, and then also providing windows for states to actually decide how much protection they can give. And when we look at even domestic partnership statutes and civil union statutes where LGBTQ couples can, who are not married, can obtain certain benefits, there are only 12 distinct states that provide those benefits. There are hypotheticals in the materials. I'm going to kind of skip through that because we really want to, I really do need to spend some time on estate planning. So in the materials, you will see information regarding estate planning for LGBTQ couples, case law and issues regarding LGBTQ couples who are married and unmarried. But with respect to estate planning, let's consider this in the light of everything, excuse me, that I've just talked about. The climate where at one point marriage equality was the high, and now we have courts and legislatures actually reversing the trend to protect and emboldening the trend to deprive individuals of protections. So it's very important that we, as estate planning attorneys, provide protections, and not just for the newly married, but also the older couples who may or may not be married, because older couples are also the most vulnerable, some of the most vulnerable in our population. And there is a case in the materials that really describes how older single members of the LGBTQ community can really be discriminated against and have a very challenging time. But again, it's important for us to provide proactive estate planning across life stages and marital states of persons. So it's imperative for young adults, especially those who don't reside in the same jurisdiction as their parents, to have the appropriate instruments, designating agents and personal representatives who can make health care and financial decisions on their behalf if they become hospitalized. If an unmarried LGBTQ couple has children, the issue of both parties in the couple being recognized as a fiduciary becomes even more important if their child resides in an unfriendly jurisdiction. So estate planners for unmarried LGBTQ persons must not only consider planning for their clients, but we also must consider the fact that their children may cause problems if they are not also protected. What if your client is unmarried but has a minor grandchild and your client was nominated as guardian? Does your client know about it? What are the implications for your client? In Illinois, a guardian can be a guardian of the person, a guardian of the estate, or a guardian of the estate and person. It could be limited. It could be plenary. Does your client have the authority to remove the minor child to your client's jurisdiction in case the grandchild is currently in an unfriendly jurisdiction? Mature couples with adult children are no longer maybe in their wealth accumulation phase. They must have not only estate planning instruments in place, but also elder care planning. And there is a difference in these plannings. Estate planning is directed at transferring assets at or in consideration of death, whereas elder care planning is actually directed at caring for older persons while they are still alive. So it's really important for us to recognize that though these two disciplines overlap, there still is difference, and we have to consider the issues regarding unfriendly jurisdictions, regarding unfriendly hospitals and institutions, regarding children living in unfriendly jurisdictions as we plan for our older clients as well. Perhaps they are not married but have grandchildren, so occasionally a see-through trust is needed in these occasions, where most planning professionals don't necessarily prefer establishing one. If it's best for our clients, then we have to just grin and bear it. Revocable living trust, while primarily probate avoidance mechanisms, are especially important when planning for unmarried LGBTQ older persons. Not only are jurisdictions and legislatures kind of reversing the trend in terms of providing and recognizing protections, but just in today's era of banking regulations and the prevalence of fraud against and financial elder exploitation, it's critical that our unmarried LGBTQ couples and individuals select trustees carefully and establish a relationship with the financial institutions with whom they'll be collaborating sooner rather than later. Because as I mentioned, financial institutions are more amenable to working with a trustee with whom the institution has a relationship with instead of an agent under a power of attorney or trustee with whom the institution is becoming involved with for the first time as a result of the older person's incapacity. In addition to revocable living trusts and proactive vehicles that can be used to establish elder care planning, other schemes should be also established for older couples with no dependents, letters of instruction for children or fiduciaries. An alternative residential plan should be established for time when independence wanes. Heaven forbid that your client needs to move and is forced because of a lack of means or a lack of knowledge and information, they move into a facility that is hostile to their personhood. A care plan that addresses what the client wants in the event of incapacity that is not necessarily provided in estate planning instruments should be considered, such as what should be in their rooms or living quarters or what kind of activities they want to take part in if possible. In the materials is also an asset-based checklist of proactive legal protections. And so again, like it's asset-based. So if your client has nominal assets, we all know about transfers via operation of law. The very first thing, of course, is a whole lot of life insurance, prepaid funeral, cremation, or memorial services, the joint tenancy with rights of survivorship mechanisms, joint accounts, payable on death accounts. As I mentioned, if your client is older with nominal assets, research friendly nursing homes and not necessarily assisted living facilities because my understanding right now, at least, is that right now nursing homes are more regulated than assisted living facilities. Establish comprehensive advance directives. And for all of our LGBTQ clients, comprehensive advance directives are probably the linchpin for their estate plan to ensure that it goes, that it is executed and implemented in the way that's beneficial for them. I'm going to wrap up. Not a lot of time left, but again, just want to hit establish like I said, comprehensive advanced directive expressly prohibiting hostile birth family members, expressly prohibiting being placed in unfriendly facilities, expressly prohibiting being attended to by knowingly unfriendly practitioners, expressly providing the partner as agent and providing the agent with a certain amount of discretionary authority, attaching statutory language, evidencing the agent does not have to be a family member, using a hospital visitation authorization form with cross-referencing between that form and a healthcare power of attorney form. And that form is that we actually have a sample in the materials. In terms of the assets, we in the materials you'll see how to assist individuals who are, as we say, house rich, cash poor, who have substantial assets. It's really important also if they're cohabiting, perhaps a property sharing agreement or a group home agreement will also help them. To really wrap things up, right now, today's climate, as I stated and as I've kind of discussed, is moving away from recognizing and proactively providing protections for LGBTQ couples and persons, regardless of Obergefell, and regardless of Windsor, regardless of Lawrence v. Texas. As we know, when we create instruments, some of the language that we provide must be flexible, as is the language in those opinions. And so because it is flexible, when it can provide protections and it's used to provide protections, those cases are very helpful. But at the same time, as we saw in Romer v. Evans, discussing morals and the importance of addressing morals can also be used as a double-edged sword to say because of morals, protections should not necessarily be provided, or what about protecting my rights and morals? So it's important in this climate to go back and review and understand that marriage equality didn't just happen. It started almost 40 years ago, and review the language in those cases and in context of the statutes and legislation that is being proposed and supported today, and do what we can with our instruments to protect our clients. So thank you so very much for joining me today. I hope you find the materials very helpful. I hope you found some of the suggestions and topics and cases that I discussed very helpful. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. My information is in the materials, but you can always contact me at Max Elliott, MELLIOTT@maxelliottlaw.com. Thank you again, and have a good day.